Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Helen Arnie.
I'm Matt Parker.
I'm Steve Mould, and you're listening to a podcast of Unnecessary Detail, a podcast where we talk in detail about the details behind the details.
Yes, it's details all the way down.
In this detailed episode, we'll be talking about input and output, which means I'll be discussing an algorithm that won an Oscar.
I'll be explaining how computers talk to each other behind our backs and how that's actually a good thing.
I'm talking about one of my songs, which Steve thinks is the funniest I've ever written, and how it wasn't actually me that wrote it.
What?
Yeah.
I feel a bit betrayed, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Steve. Let's do some detail. So this episode is input and output. Steve, what are you putting in and what are you getting out?
So I want to talk about this video that I made a while back. It's a YouTube video. And if you look at the thumbnail of the video, it's got text on it. It says something like, this video has 526,243 views. And that's always right. So whenever you go to the video and look at the thumbnail, the text on the screen will match the number of views that the video actually has.
And how many has Tom Scott's equivalent video had?
We don't talk about that.
Oh.
Actually, we sort of talk about it. So I had this idea to make a video where the number of views is written on the thumbnail because Tom Scott previously had made a video where the number of views is in the title of the video. And I thought, well, what's a bit harder than that? Making the thumbnail match instead of the title. So the title of my video is actually the number of likes that the video has, and it compares it to Tom's. So it says this video has 62,325 likes, which is 3 million less than Tom's.
Because his videos are the tens of millions.
It is. I think it's like 40 million on his.
Can we just acknowledge before we start that at one level, this is deeply underwhelming? Because what you're saying is, if you look at that page on YouTube, there's a number here, but it's also slightly above as well.
Yeah, I get that that's underwhelming. But I guess if you know what the challenge is, then it's interesting. But yeah, on paper, it's like, well, who cares?
But this is a podcast of unnecessary detail. So if this isn't something we can talk about on the podcast, I literally have no idea what we can talk about.
Tom mentions this in his video. Like, what's the best way to achieve that? You could hire someone to just refresh the page, and you know, and every time the view count changes, they log into your YouTube account and change the title and the thumbnail of the video. That's one way to do it. Or slightly better, but only slightly better, is to get some software, to write some software that does that. So you write some code that refreshes the web page, the code looks for the view count on the web page, and then the software that you've written logs into your YouTube account and changes the thumbnail and the title. If you do that, that's called web scraping. And if you're a software developer that does web scraping, it's basically an exercise in just being frustrated and then it breaks. Because there's a bit on the page, an HTML tag that holds the view count. So you have to tell the software to find that tag, but it won't just be the view count. It'll be like, it'll say views colon space. And then, so you've got to get rid of that bit, and then you're left with the number, but it's got commas in it. You've got to get rid of the commas, otherwise your software's not going to understand it. And then a week later, YouTube slightly changes the layout of its webpage and your software's broken.
I did it that way and it broke. So I can absolutely confirm that.
You did that?
Wow.
I had a web scraper. Because I was doing videos on my channel and on Numberphile, I wanted a spreadsheet that would add them all together, all the videos I'd done, so I could put in the ID codes for all these videos. My software would load them up in a browser, scrape the whole page, and like you're saying, Steve, it would search for the word views.
Yeah.
And then back up in the position in the, like, the massive string of text from this website, it would back up until it finds some digits and then keep backing up until there were no more digits and then go forwards writing down the digits, ignoring commas.
But wouldn't it be easier for programmers if YouTube made that information available in a way that was easy for software to read? Like, a web page is easy for humans to read. Can we present the data, but differently, in a way that's good for software? And that solution is called an API, an application protocol interface, and it's revolutionized computing. APIs dominate our lives and we never really think about them. Like, these days, if you're a computer that has data, it often makes sense to have an API as well. For example, Transport for London, they have loads of data about arrival times and things like that. So, for example, if you go to Transport for London, you can look up, when's the next bus at this particular bus stop? And it's a nice website and it's human readable and it looks easy on our eyes. But if you take the URL of that website, it's going to be something like tfl.gov.uk/buses/bus stop/, you know, and there's like the code for that bus stop. If you take that URL and just change it a little bit, but you keep the code for the bus stop, instead of getting this really nice web page, you just get this block of text. And it looks like code, you know, it's got like square brackets, curly brackets, colons, things like that. Because it's not for human eyes. It's not a web page. It's just text and numbers that is easy for software to understand.
So behind the real website, there's another secret website that computers use instead of the human-friendly one.
Yeah.
But only if someone set it up like that.
Someone's got to think, what if a computer wants to get the bus?
Yeah, computers haven't set up like their version of Facebook.
So hang on, is this something to do with Bus Watch, Steve? Because I'm just remembering when we used to meet in real life back in the before times, you used to have a watch, like a smartwatch, and you'd look at your watch and be like, bus leaving in 7 minutes. And we'd be like, is he doing that?
So I did use the TFL API because there's a bus stop outside my house. The bus comes every about 10 minutes, but there's no system to it. So it's nice to be able to look it up and see when's the next bus. As I'm running around the house trying to get ready, I can see on my watch, because I wrote an app for my Pebble watch that consumes the TFL API and just shows me on my watch, look, it's 5 minutes before the next bus stop. There's another one after that, which is 11 minutes away. And so I know that I've got like 3 minutes to get ready and get out of the house down to the bus stop. So I love APIs because they're fun to play with and you can write software that uses them. And it's everywhere. It's like, you know, we have a Shopify store. We sell stuff and that has an API.
Maskier.com.
Yeah. And
excuse me, sorry.
I wasn't talking about Maskier.
Which one did you choose to say there?
The one that I knew you wouldn't mention, so I thought I would.
You're just like, oh, let's ignore that this is a Festival of the Spoken Nerd podcast.
Oh, yeah, festivalofthespokennerd.com/shop/buses.
A really good example of how APIs have changed the way we do things is Amazon. Like, in the early days, back when they were just selling books and losing money, Jeff Bezos decreed from on high that from now on, different departments aren't allowed to ask each other for information. Like, if you're in the marketing department, you can't go over to the sales department and say, look, can you give me the numbers on the sales of blah, blah? You're not allowed to do that anymore. If you want the information, the sales department have to write an API for accessing that data. And you in the marketing department have to write software that uses that API and pulls the information and displays it to you. And Jeff Bezos said, if you don't do that, you're fired. And that was genuinely the culture. Like, people were scared of being fired, so everyone did it. What it meant was, like, you might have someone over here in Amazon who's in charge of, like, building the software that puts books online for sale. And that person has written an API for using that stuff. And then someone else in a different department thinks, well, you know what? I mean, we could use that API to sell jewelry. And so suddenly Amazon is selling jewelry as well as books. That's how Amazon got to the point of, like, selling it like anything they want to. It meant that they learned a lot of lessons, like, internally, because someone would produce an API that was really useful for accessing some of the data that they have. So someone else in another department is like, right, I'm just going to query that API every second and have it displayed on my computer, right? but it's really computationally expensive, you know, whatever that query is. And someone else in another department hears about how useful it is, so they start doing it every second, and suddenly your server crashes. So they need to start worrying about quotas and, or, you know, authentication and, you know, spam.
So if someone uses an API, yeah, depending on how it's set, yeah, up, the website or the computer that you're querying has to do some computational work.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, let's say someone's needlessly, I don't know, pinging YouTube because they want to update their thumbnail or something. Right? That's adding additional load onto someone else's computer system, which is going to cause problems.
Yeah. So for example, like, I would like to have my thumbnail update every 5 seconds, but I'm not allowed because I have a quota. And you can actually go in the back end of Google's API and you can see what different things cost. So, like, looking up the view count costs you 10 points, and updating a title of a video costs 10 points, let's say, but I've only got 10,000 points a day available to me, or something like that. So I can't remember the numbers, that's definitely wrong, but basically I'm only allowed to update the thumbnail and title once every, I think it's 5 or 10 minutes.
I hit the Google Sheets API limit on my Christmas tree.
Pardon?
Because I had the 500, remember I had the 500 LED Christmas tree where I could program all these crazy lighting effects in 3D, yeah, on my Christmas tree, and I put a video out on it. During the year, I got bored, and so I linked it to a Google Sheet. And then because when I was doing talks online, I would share the Google Sheet with the people watching the talk, and they could go and put RGB values in the spreadsheet, and then my tree would change to match the colors that were in the spreadsheet.
I am enjoying the assumption that people will have time and inclination to go and do something in a spreadsheet rather than listen to your talk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I know my audience very well.
You're saying they're really good at multitasking, not that they aren't interested in your talk.
Doodling in a spreadsheet. Well, actually, I underestimated the interest because I thought a few people would go and do this. The spreadsheet was inundated with people. And I was, foolishly, I coded it. I was API asking for one cell at a time. And when everything kicked off in the spreadsheet, Google's like, nah, mate, too many requests, and shut it down.
Wow.
I had to rewrite the software. Now, you can just get the whole spreadsheet at once, bring it all back, and then do the analyzing at my end. And I don't know what the points allocation is for that, Steve, but Google was way happier with me just getting the whole thing at once and then dealing with it myself versus getting the cells individually from them.
Wow. APIs, not just for Christmas, guys.
Mm. No. That's exactly right. What's interesting, just to bring it back to the story of Amazon, is that they dealt with all these problems that naturally come with APIs. And it got to the point where they could then make these APIs available to the public. So not only is Amazon selling books and jewelry and tools and whatever, I can now sell on Amazon using their API. What that means is, right, our Shopify account, Festival of the Spoken Nerd, has an API because it's based on Shopify. Shopify has an API. You can get Shopify's API to talk to Amazon's API, and now we can sell our stuff on Amazon as well as on our Shopify website because of APIs. And what's crazy is all of these different things that Amazon are doing, selling products, it's all based on websites, right? You buy and sell on the Amazon website. And this website has APIs as well. So now if you want to build a website and host it somewhere, you can host it on Amazon servers. It's called Amazon Web Services. And more than half of Amazon's profits are from Amazon Web Services. So, you know, you think of Amazon as a company that sells products, and they do that, but most of their profit comes from hosting websites.
You can't avoid them. Like, if you wanted to boycott Amazon, let's say you think they've got a toxic work environment that fires people for talking to each other and not using an API, and you want to avoid Amazon, you can't. Like, even right now, because we're talking over Zoom while we're recording remotely for this podcast, Zoom chats are hosted by Amazon Web Services.
Oh, you're kidding.
Like you said, Netflix, like, you cannot avoid AWS.
You can't. I mean, the biggest thing is LinkedIn. How can you wean yourself off LinkedIn?
I mean, how would I network?
How would you network otherwise? The BBC uses Amazon. Even Facebook uses Amazon for some things. Twitter. All this made me think that maybe we should have an API for this particular podcast episode. Like, I'm sure we could code something up.
Oh.
Like, maybe some sort of comparative thing between me and Matt. So, because we're both on YouTube and YouTube has an API. That's what I was thinking.
And we've both got about a million subscribers.
It's about a million, so we could track how much more I have than you, for example.
Whoa, I mean, that could be a negative value, just, you know.
It could be. I would probably...
I think we have to...
It depends on how I code it. It might crash if it goes negative. Who knows?
We could do it as a ratio.
Yeah. Assuming that I actually build this API, which I will, then let's say the URL is going to be festivalofthespokennerd.com/API. I'll also leave a link to that in the show notes. If you go to festivalofthespokennerd.com/podcasts, you can find it there as well. I did actually look at, because I was looking at, you know, how did Jeff Bezos get so rich? I did start to think, you know, this expression, raking it in, if you're raking it in, how much is he raking in? I made an assumption of one rake per 4 seconds or something like that. I worked out that if you crumpled up $100 bills and laid them like one layer crumpled up on the floor, tightly packed, and you were raking that, then you would rake in as much as Jeff Bezos is raking in. Matt, do you have any input? I mean, what I'm saying is, what's your output?
I have some random output. I mean, more so than usual. Yeah, I've come with the random noise that won an Academy Award. So this is Oscar award-winning randomness, which I find deeply pleasing. And it kind of makes sense, because it's often in life, randomness is good, particularly if you're trying to simulate nature. So if you want something to look organic, it can't be too systematic or it looks artificial. It's also useful in things like playing games and whatnot. You want to have some randomness. And before we even start, I just want to deal with one problem. I'm going to say randomness. I'm going to say things that are random. I'm often talking about things that are pseudo-random, because the downside to true random is it's unpredictable and it can't be repeated. So if you were, I don't know, developing a new Snakes and Ladders game and you want to test it, you could roll a dice over and over to get your results. But then you afterwards, you'd be like, well, I don't have any record of that. And if someone else tests it, they're going to get something different. So what you could do is just have a big book where someone's previously rolled a dice over and over and over again. And then you follow along in the book with those results. And that's good for debugging and testing things, because it's always the same.
Matt, are you trying to hint at what your next book is going to be?
You used to be able to buy random numbers in a book. And the reviews online are like obviously people are like, still a better love story than Twilight, all that stuff, you know.
Wow.
The reviews on books of random numbers are glorious. It's the internet at their finest. But sadly now, it tends to be, you'll find some mathematical function that generates numbers with the same distribution and properties of a pure random number. Like a dice or a coin or something, but it's repeatable, predictable, and so it's way easier if you're debugging, testing something, repeating anything. You got more than one person working on it. You want pseudo random.
So is it a bit like if you used the first however many digits of pi or something, which is like irrational, randomish? I mean, maybe that doesn't fit the bill, but it's a fixed thing that someone else can go, oh, I'll use that, and when I test my thing with these random numbers, I'll get the same amount of randomness?
Yeah, exactly that. Because people often associate randomness with being unpredictable and different. No, it can be predetermined, but still function as a random variable. So one of the features of the award-winning random noise is it's always the same. If you look up the same bit, you'll always get the same thing. And I'll explain more about that in a moment.
Can I just check whether Academy Award-winning randomness is the harshest film review in history?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like it's avant-garde Dadaism filmmaking. It's like this is the random noise that you will then implement in a film. And actually, it came out of work on the 1982 film Tron. It didn't win a prize for a film it was in. They have these separate Academy Awards for like technical achievement. And the noise specifically, the algorithm that generates this noise, won the award. It wasn't the implementation of it. It wasn't its use in a film. The noise itself was Academy Award winning.
That's insane.
That's amazing.
An Academy Award just for nerdy noise.
It's great. I'm working on a YouTube video about this noise because a friend of ours, Seb Lee Delisle, who does massive laser installations, invited me up to see a huge installation he did in Leeds recently where he was lasering lightning bolts onto a building. Absolutely amazing. But in the process of working on that, I was like, oh, I want to be able to visualize this noise. So I was generating 2D noise animations to use in the video. And whenever my wife walked into the room, I'd be like, hey, Lucy, look, I've just made an Academy Award winning film. I'm like, do you want to see my latest Oscar winning animation? And you might think she'd get tired of that, but you're wrong. Hey, she started tired of that just out of the gates. So the reason Seb was using it is he wanted to have a lightning bolt that was like zigging and zagging backwards and forwards. But he wanted that to look like an organic lightning bolt. And so what you can do if you're ever faced with a situation where you don't want pure randomness, you want more organic randomness, is you go to, I imagine it as like Narnia for randomness. It's like a magical land where you can go and you can retrieve randomness. And in the two-dimensional case, you can imagine it as a landscape of hills and troughs and valleys and ups and downs. And what you do is you pick a location in the magical world of randomness, and then you measure its altitude, and that's your random number. And it means if you want a series of random numbers that naturally move from, like, depend on the previous one, but they fluctuate in a nice, continuous, non-jarring fashion, you pick a starting point in the magical land of randomness, and then you start moving in a direction. And as you walk along, you keep track of how the altitude's changing, and that's your changing variable. So what Seb was doing was defining a path, or like a route you can walk in the magical randomness land, and then moving that path sideways. And so the path was his lightning bolt going backwards and forwards. He was using the altitude to change how far it was going from side to side. And then by moving it sideways through time, that would animate it. So as it went to the side, that would cause it all to wobble backwards and forwards. The reason why that's so much better than normal random noise is normal randomness, it would just be jumping all over the shop because each point doesn't depend on the previous one. Whereas if you got nice, smooth, continuous noise, then it moves backwards and forwards nice and seamlessly.
I feel like I have a solution to the random jumping around
problem. Hey, yep, hit me with it.
And it's a simple one. I want to share it, but then again, if I keep it secret, then maybe I can win an Academy Award.
You can get an Academy Award.
Yeah.
Tell Steve.
Do you know what? I'll tell you.
This is I'll name on it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll give it to the world, okay? Yep. You already have your random line, which is the lightning.
Yep.
And when you animate it, you just use a random number to decide, you know, how much am I going to move it? Instead of just jumping to a new location, you have a range of values that tells you how far is each point on the lightning going to move left or right. And if you keep that within a nice range, then isn't that a solution? Or have I missed something?
Close. You've kicked the can one derivative down the road. So now your position will move continuously, but it's going to be changing direction super erratically. And so the benefit of using this magical land of noise is it'll go one way for a while and then naturally slow down, then come back the other way. Whereas if you've just got a pure randomness changing the direction, it'll just be juddering all over the shop.
Although, Steve, you're not far off in that you were thinking, how can we use like randomness to move from one bit to another randomly? You're not a million miles away from how this noise actually works. And so it's called Perlin noise. Technically, it's now simplex noise because it's been updated and it's now more computationally efficient. I still call it Perlin noise. It's like, you know, I still say I'm going to film a video when I'm not using film anymore. I'm just using the original name.
Right.
So by saying Perlin noise, all the kids are like, all right, grandpa. But hey, that's the original noise that Ken Perlin, that's why it's named after, came up with because of Tron. Perlin's idea was you start with this, you've got this landscape that you want to give it some random ups and downs. So the technical details, and this is so nice for people who are into this, you put a grid over your landscape. The original Perlin noise used a square grid, and that's actually the difference. Modern simplex noise, same idea, uses a triangle grid, so it splits into triangles. It's actually easier to compute. Fun fact. The original version used a square grid, and you put a random value at every intersection of the grid, and then you use that.
A standard random value.
The original one just used every possible value and then shuffled them. And the way that you shuffle them was like the seed for then the randomness you had in your landscape. It's actually, you're giving it a random vector that you put at every single intersection point. And so the original Perlin noise had a finite set of vectors that were then shuffled according to this permutation list that Ken came up with. But somehow, you put random vectors at every single corner. And then for the in-between points, you look at the directional vector to all the corners of whichever square you're in the grid, and you take the dot product of the vector between the point in the corner and the random vector at the corner, and then you've got a way of combining all of those together, like all four or three if you're using triangles, to give you your random value at that point. And the way you combine them and weight them is important, so you keep a nice continuous set of values. But the general, like the high order concept is, if you make the randomness at a specific point based on the direction and distance of the corners around it, as you move that point around, the angle to the other corners is changing nice and continuously. So you still got the randomness of the values at the corners, but then you're mixing it with the nice continuous change of the direction to those corners. And don't get me wrong, it's a non-trivial bit of computing to put it all together. But what you end up with is by assigning these random values at all the corners of the grid, you then get this nice continuous random surface that joins them all together. And that is your Perlin noise or simplex noise. And you're not limited to two dimensions. You can do the same thing in three dimensions. The original one would use a cube lattice. And simplex noise uses tetrahedra to divide up space. And that's actually why it changed. Each time you go up a dimension, if you're using cubes, you get twice as many corners, twice as many vertices. Whereas if you're using simplexes, which is the generalized name for a triangle in any dimension, you've only got one extra vertex per dimension. And so if you're computing it in higher dimensions, it's way less additional computation compared to the original Perlin noise.
Because cubes have eight corners and tetrahedra have four.
Four, exactly. And a 4D tetrahedron only has five corners, whereas a 4D cube has 16. And then so cube corners, like in 5D, you've got 32 corners on your cube. You've only got six on your tetrahedron. So it's way, way fewer corners if you can split your space up into higher dimensional triangles versus higher dimensional squares.
That is a timely reminder that in my future five dimensional house, everything should be tetrahedral, not cuboid, or I will run out of space really soon.
Well, it'll just be really hard to compute where to put things in the house.
This actually ties into a little project Helen and I did to try and make this a podcast-friendly demonstration of random noise, where I thought I would generate some truly random tunes for Helen to play on the piano and some Perlin noise random
tunes.
I gave Matt a range that I can sing in, so my lowest easy singing note and my highest easy singing note, and I gave him a scale, which was A major or C sharp minor, for any scale fans out there. And initially I gave you a starting note of A. You also did me some C sharps, and I think the ones starting on C sharp are the ones that sounded better. And you sent me loads of different ones. I found, I think, the most tuneful Perlin one, and I've added rhythm and phrasing so it comes across as a melody. And I this was hard, found the most tuneful random one, and I did my best.
I generated equal numbers of each, for the record.
Yeah, equal numbers of notes. They've come out quite different. And our wonderful producer Lindsay is going to play them in for us. Lindsay, can you play in the random one first, and let's see how tuneful you think this is. Thank you very much.
I mean,
I'll take
my
Oscar on the way out.
You've made something from not a lot. I got to give it to you.
I mean, to call it jazz is a disservice to jazz, isn't it?
So
it's very freestyle.
It's super freestyle. And the thing that's noticeable about it is it jumps everywhere. It goes to like the highest note in my range. It goes to the lowest note in my range. And everywhere in between, it completely randomly. The Perlin one was so much easier and more pleasant to set as a tune, and I hope to listen to. Lindsay, can we play that one? I mean, I'm not going to say it's like hands in the air, C-H-O-O-N tune, but I hope that you can
better.
Hear it. It's like, it's better.
Yeah.
I got a
feeling from it. You know what I mean?
Oh, thank you.
Oh, it's melancholy, you know? Yeah. Whereas the other one, it's like, I guess the notes are in that key, but it's like, I'm not really getting a feeling from it.
Steve, you've summarized the difference. The random one, it's got all the signals that it's a melody and it jumps around. But the Perlin one actually makes you feel something.
Yeah.
Even though it's randomly generated, it actually feels natural. It feels like it's been crafted. It's an unbelievable difference, huge difference, I think, between the two.
Award-winning difference.
Thank you.
As always, I mean, what gives it its natural feel is the previous, like the next note, like it's randomness, but it depends on the previous note because it's coming from a continuous function. And what's interesting about Perlin noise compared to true randomness is because it's based on these grid corners, there's a scale, different meaning of the word scale. There's a scale to Perlin noise. So when Helen and I were working out how to turn Perlin noise into music, we had to decide how far we would move through the randomness landscape before sampling the random variable again and then moving it. Because if you don't move much at all, it'd be the same note over and over and over and over again. If you move too far, you're back to pure randomness because you're skipping so far ahead in the landscape. It has no resemblance to where you just were. And so we ended up, the tune you heard, we were moving half a grid length between each note, but we weren't moving in the direction of the grid. We were moving on a weird angle through the 3D noise. One of the things about this random noise, and the reason it is award-winning, is when it's used properly, you don't even notice it, because it means you can procedurally generate very natural-looking organic scenes, and done properly, it just looks like the thing it looks like. So in the Pixar film Brave, the forests were generated using random noise. And I passed over this briefly before, where I talk about how you can have a seed for your randomness. It's like choosing what dice you want to roll or something. The number you put in that then determines what pseudo-randomness you get out. And in the Brave film, they used one of the developers' phone numbers was the seed for the random noise that then generated the forests in the background. And in the code, like when they're writing the code for this, they put a comment next to it. So they've got like the seed equals and then their phone number. And then there's a comment right next to it that says, call me if you don't understand this. So if anyone came across, like, oh, how do I explain random, like pseudo-random noise in a seed? I know. I'll just make my phone number the seed. And then if anyone gets stuck on it, they'll give me a call. And it looks like a phone number, and we'll deal with it. The issue is that developer changed their phone number. And so they dutifully went back and changed the random seed. And that meant, because the seed is different, the forests were completely changed. They still looked natural. They still looked very similar. But they had, like, totally altered the way they looked, because they now were using a different random number seed. And apparently there was, in their words, that created some panic in a handful of teams for about half a day across two films. All the vegetation of two films that were in production suddenly changed because the developer changed their phone number. That was the random seed.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Well, Steve's given us computer inputs and I've had some random outputs to tie it all together. Helen, what have you got?
My job is pretty much to take inputs and turn them into outputs. That's what I do when the input is information and the output is a song, right? So I sometimes get asked to write songs using this creative scientific system, and I got commissioned by BBC Radio 3 to write a song for their wonderful show called The Verb, which they wanted me to co-write and create the ultimate love song. And I was like, this is my kind of commission. I'm going to use a scientific method to create the ultimate love song, which is going to be the absolute best love song that resonates with the maximum possible number of people across the globe, right? But I obviously didn't want to share my meager BBC standard contributor fee with an actual human co-writer, because toddler shoes don't buy themselves. And I picked my co-writer, and my co-writer is an algorithm, or more specifically, a series of algorithms, to be even more specific, but actually slightly vague at the same time. I picked my co-writer to be a popular internet search engine that rhymes with Bugle.
Bing doesn't rhyme with Bugle.
I mean, neither does Google. But anyway, so I searched for the most popular love song lyrics that I could find on Google, right? And because of the way that Google uses algorithms, it serves up things that other people have been looking for and have found useful. It serves up things influenced by your settings, by your location, your language. It serves up things that are globally happening in that moment, right? And so this song, when I wrote it, was a co-written song that myself and the algorithm believed was full of stuff that people were truly looking for in a love song, right? So I found loads and loads of love song lyrics and put them all into a song, thinking that this would create the ultimate love song. It didn't go quite as I thought. And I've actually got a live recording of this song. So I'm going to play out this live recording. Now, this is from Ada Lovelace Day Live, which I hosted a couple of years ago. And Ada Lovelace Day Foundation are fantastic. They do loads of supporting women in science and technology and networking and mentoring and resources and stuff all the year round. So go and check them out, because they've let me use this recording. Because as you listen to it, you will realise why this needs to be performed in front of an audience of more than two people. So I present to you the ultimate algorithmically enabled love song ever written.
Broken heart, how can I tell you how I feel, and how can I make you love me? I just want to hold you close, just want to make you happy, but I can't find the words to say I love you. We shared a night together, tell me when will I see you again. Loving you is easy, let's make this moment last, 'cause I'm loving this feeling. When you wish upon a star, it makes no difference who you are if you don't say you love me. All you need is love, and I think I'm in love with you. So please, let me love you.
Okay. Now, I've got to tell you, I was pretty disappointed. Because every single one of those lines taken individually is a love song classic. But when you put them together, it creates something quite bland. And I don't think that's a good love song. So I thought, actually, right, if you take out of the search algorithm all of the lines that are already in other love songs, maybe that creates a song about what people are really looking for. So I did exactly the same search again. I searched for the beginning of every line, but instead of taking the first returned search, I took the second one. So I've rewritten the song to be about what we're all really looking for. Love is a verb. Love. Actually, Love Island 2018. Love. Lace, comma. Augusta Ada's King Noel, comma. Countess of. How can I mend a broken zip? How can I tell what iPhone I have? And how can I make YouTube safer for my child? I just want a hippopotamus for Christmas. Just want to make a phone
pdflatex.fmt. We shared a bowl of sugar. Tell me, when will I see results from the gym? Loving you is complicated. Let's make America great again. Because I'm loving angles instead. Okay, that's a weird one, because that one, popular search engines base it on your previous search history as well. I've done a show called Helen Arney, Voice of an Angle. Now my search history is tainted forever. Oh, when you wish upon a brunch, it makes no difference who you vote for. If you say Uno, how many cards do you pick up? All you need is love and a dog. And I think I'm in love with myself. Love is in the hair. So please, let me Google that for you.
Honestly, I'm amazed at your skill of creating, like, the first half. Like, if I heard that in the charts, I'd be like, yeah, that's a pop song. Yeah.
Wow.
That's a song about love.
You have no, yeah. Steve, I would question your discernment of what is a good pop song, but then I know that
I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised to see it there.
That's okay. All right, that's different, and that's fine.
This is more about Steve's opinion of popular music than your song.
It definitely does. Yeah. I look back at writing that song, and that was in 2018, which was at the most fulsome time of the American elections, where something weird happened every time I re-googled, because sometimes I sort of re-googled the lines to see if I could get a better version at a different time of day. And weirdly, when it was in the middle of the night in America, I would write the line, "Let's make," and it would offer me, "Let's make a baby together."
Oh, wow.
But when America was awake, it would offer me, "Let's make America great again." So it proved to me that actually, yeah, the events that are happening globally and locally do change what you get back.
I get "Let's make a deal."
Do you? Are you Googling my song in real time?
Yeah. I'm doing a remix. I hope you don't mind.
You are doing the 2021 post-COVID remix.
2021 Matt Search History remix. I think my on the record opinions of the maths behind Deal or No Deal maybe is
no, Let's Make a Deal is an American television show,
is
so
it?
A lot of people are searching for it. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh,
okay, I'm gonna try it, because I this is very much of its time, right? If we tried to Google every single line of the song, we would get quite different things for some of them, depending on current events, and we would get quite classic things for others, right? Because if you imagine, right, if you're in Britain, where we are now, and you Google the word Latin, like, if you do that now, you'll get, like, the classic language of the Roman Empire. But if you Google that in Texas on the border of Mexico, you're going to get quite a different answer, one would expect. Like, I am not there right now. But Latin has a different connotation depending on where you are in the world and what global events are happening, right? If I put "Let's make art," I also get "Let's make art," but I also get "Let's make Africa green again," followed by "Let's make America great again." So that just tells you how far that phrase has fallen in popularity globally and locally. Making Africa green again is more important than making America great again. It's COP26 week when we're recording this. Seems so obvious now I say that, right? Ooh, the algorithms know what's happening.
Yeah. What's another beginning line?
How can I mend a broken heart?
How can I...
How can I watch the fight tonight?
How can I buy Bitcoin in the UK?
Yeah. How can I mend a zip? I got zip. How can I mend my marriage?
How can I mend a broken relationship?
Yeah, some of them go pretty dark pretty quickly. Yeah. I think I'm in love with you, the girl next door, someone, my friend, someone else. That's dark. And I think I'm in love with a girl who works on checkout 6 in Decathlon.
Yeah, I've got that. Lyrics.
Really?
It says at the end.
Yeah. Matt, have you put your Google settings onto not culturally aware or something?
No, it's just learnt that.
It's
correctly learnt. It's like, look, this guy's pretty blissfully unaware of pop culture. Let's keep it that way.
So I hope everyone has a lot of fun listening to that song. By the way, that song is available on our Bandcamp page. So if you go to helenani.bandcamp.com, you'll find an album of all of the songs that appear on all of the Unnecessary Detail podcasts, and you can download them all for free or give us some money if you feel like it. But also, I would love anyone who has come up with a really good second choice lyric that has changed since I wrote this song. If you Google the lyrics and you come up with some really good second choices, I would love to hear them. You can email podcast@festivalofthespokennerd.com. You can tweet us or whatever at FOTSN or at Helenani, or you can tweet at Steve and Matt, because it might help change their search history. That would really help.
Well, that is all the output we've got for today's set of inputs.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, which is part of the Acast Creator Network. Woo!
If you want even more details, check out the show notes. They're also available at festivalofthespokennerd.com/podcast. There you'll find links to the videos we've mentioned in this episode, free downloads of Helen's songs from the series, probably some free code from me and Matt as well, if you want to have a bit of algorithmic fun in your own time.
We would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. And by us, we mean the podcast specifically. It actually does make a big difference to how many people get to hear about the podcast, and it may impact how many episodes we can make in the future.
And if you have any unnecessary detail for us, or some alternative lyrics for me, or just want to get in touch, podcast@festivalofthespokennerd.com is our email. And we're on all the social media, so come and find us and say hi. But for now, we'll say bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
A podcast of Unnecessary Detail is made by Festival of the Spoken Nerd. That's Helen Arney, Steve Mould and Matt Parker. Our series producer is Lindsay Fenner, who also produced this episode. Our theme music is by Howard Carter, and we're proud to be part of the Acast Creator Network. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.